Two themes emerged as Alberto Gonzalez faced the Senate Judiciary Committee this morning. One was the compelling American Dream story of the son of Mexican migrants who enlisted in the Air Force and went on to college and Harvard Law School. He later served then-Governor George W. Bush in Texas as general counsel, as Secretary of State, and was appointed to the Texas Supreme Court. He followed his patron to Washington as White House counsel and is now widely expected to be confirmed as Attorney General of the United States. He would be the first Latino to hold that position. The other theme centers on questions about what Alberto Gonzalez has done in those positions. He was asked sharp questions today about adherence to the rule of law, about the so-called torture memo that expanded the limits of forcible interrogation and, some say, paved the way to alleged abuses at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay, about adherence to the Geneva Convention, which he once described as obsolete and quaint, about the powers of the president to override the law, and whether, as Attorney General, he could be independent from his patron, the president. We'll listen to some substantial excerpts from today's hearing, hear more about Alberto Gonzalez's background in Texas, and we want to hear from you. If you have questions about who Alberto Gonzalez is, what he's done, or about the role of the Attorney General, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Michael Hirsch of Newsweek magazine was there at the Senate hearing this morning and has been kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. Good to see you again, Michael.
Good to see you again, Neil.
Senators on both sides of the Republicans and Democrats posed some tough questions to Alberto Gonzalez today. The theme was very much about the road to Abu Ghraib, and the new chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Republican Arlen Specter, decided to put some early points on the record as he began his questioning of Alberto Gonzalez about the torture pictures and allegations of abuse at Abu Ghraib.
I will begin at the outset of your testimony, Judge Gonzalez. You've already covered the matter, but I think it is important to have an unequivocal statement, and really a repeat of an unequivocal statement, of the position of the administration and your personal views. Do you approve of torture?
Absolutely not, Senator.
Do you condemn the interrogators, and you already answered this in part, at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, but again, for the record, do you condemn the interrogators' techniques at Abu Ghraib shown on the widely publicized photographs?
Let me say, Senator, that as a human being, I am sickened and outraged by those photos. But as someone who may be head of the department, I obviously don't want to provide any kind of legal opinion as to whether or not that conduct might be criminal. And we obviously, if anyone is involved in any kind of conduct that is subject to prosecution, I would not want to do anything today to prejudge that prosecution and jeopardize that prosecution. But obviously, if that conduct falls within the jurisdiction of the Department of Justice, I will pursue it aggressively, and you have my word on that.
Michael, as the questioning continued, senators tried to draw the nominee out on the distinction between what happened at Abu Ghraib and what he had seemingly written about authorizing that kind of behavior in the so-called Bybee memo, or the torture memo.
Yeah, and Gonzalez basically denied or really refused to answer questions about whether there was a policy direction based on that very significant memo that led to the abuses at Abu Ghraib. He cited pieces of some of the 8 investigations, which he repeatedly invoked, to say that these were rogue soldiers acting on the night shift, as he put it, and doing their own thing for their own amusement, and that this had nothing to do with any discussions that might have gone on back in Washington.
Now, Vermont Senator Leahy, that's ranking member, the senior Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, Pat Leahy tried to pinpoint one point that Mr. Gonzalez also addressed in his memos, the authority he contended in the memos of the United States president to override some aspects of U.S. law and treaties.
Let me then ask you, if you're going to be Attorney General, and I'll accept what you said, then let's put on the hat if you're going to be confirmed as Attorney General. The Bybee memo concludes that the president has authority as commander-in-chief. override domestic and international laws prohibiting torture and can immunize from prosecution anyone who commits torture under his act. Whether legal or not, he can immunize them. Now, as Attorney General, would you believe the President has the authority to exercise a Commander-in-Chief override and immunize acts of torture?
First of all, Senator, the President has said we're not going to engage in torture under any circumstances. And so you're asking me to answer a hypothetical that is never going to occur. This President has said we're not going to engage in torture under any circumstances, and therefore that portion of the opinion was unnecessary and was a reason that we asked that portion be withdrawn.
And Michael Hirsch, hypothetical maybe, but wasn't that exactly the hypothetical point that was addressed in one of these memos?
Oh, at great length as well. I mean, if you look at the August 1 memorandum that they're referring to, as well as Gonzalez's own memorandum to the president, they spend considerable time on the president's powers and defenses to liability, which was also something that was withdrawn in the newest memo. So it is a little bit odd. It was quite clear. There was repeated questioning on this in the second round of questioning. Senator Leahy again bored in on this question, and Gonzalez again avoided answering it directly. He simply did not want to. He was very low profile on some of these critical issues throughout the hearings.
And then there is the issue we've mentioned before about were these memos, was this policy within the White House, the Justice Department, the Pentagon, was this the start of the road to Abu Ghraib? And it was a question that Senator Leahy continued to pursue.
Do you think there's any connection whatsoever between the policies which actually you helped to formulate regarding the treatment interrogation of prisoners, policies that were sent out, the Department of Defense and elsewhere, and the widespread abuses that have occurred? Do you acknowledge any accountability for such things, any connection?
Senator, as I said in my remarks, I categorically condemn the conduct that we see reflected in these pictures at Abu Ghraib. I would refer you to the 8 completed investigations of what happened at Abu Ghraib and in Guantanamo, and there are still three ongoing. I'm talking about the Tagaba report, the Faye Jerns Kerr report, the Schlesinger report, the Navy IG, the Army IG, Jacoby, Ryder, Miller, all of these reports. And if you listen to the press briefings given in connection with the rollout of these reports, they do conclude that with respect to the conduct not reflected in the photos, not the conduct that we find the most offensive, but conduct related to pure interrogations, that there was some confusion.
The same reports you talk about say the Department of Defense relied on the memo. It's quoted extensively in the DOD working group report on interrogations. That report has never been repudiated. So apparently they did rely on their memo, and when we find out about the abuses, we never find out from the administration. We find out because the press reports them. Is there any accountability here anywhere?
And that, Michael, was one of the questions that remained unanswered.
That's right. He basically confined responsibility as far as how high up the ranks it goes to Joint Task Force 7 under General Sanchez, who, since the beginning of this scandal, has really been kind of hung out, as a scapegoat for most of this, even though we know the abuses went way beyond the province of Joint Task Force 7. And there simply was no sense from Gonzalez that even though in some of those reports, like the Schlesinger report, the conclusions specifically were that the reasoning that he himself, Gonzalez, approved, that became part of the president's February 7, 2002 memo on unlawful combatants, influenced the thinking of General Sanchez. And so, you know, there simply was a stone wall there.
And a stone wall that Senator Joseph Biden, Democrat from Delaware, tried to puncture when he said to the nominee that his answers are not responsive.
You're in no way jeopardizing a future case. That's malarkey, pure malarkey. So we're looking for candor, old buddy. We're looking for you when we ask you a question to give us an answer that you haven't done yet. I love you, but you're not very candid so far. And so please do not use this straw man.
Well, as a future attorney general, I may not be able to comment on what that law means.
You are obliged to comment. It's your job to make a judgment before a case is taken. That's your judgment we're looking at.
Michael Hirsch, did he respond?
No, he did not. That was the liveliest moment of the morning's session. But again, you had on the part of Gonzalez this placid, almost phlegmatic presence, and really, he just did not want to get himself into any hot water whatsoever. So he simply did not answer. And we reigned, as it's been really since the beginning with Gonzalez, he's been something of a cipher. He's only known as the president's lawyer. His main virtue, it appears, has been his loyalty to the president and serving the president. His views are not known. Even those who sat with him on some of these meetings that produced, ultimately, the Bybee memo say that they didn't quite know what he was thinking at the time. So we really have him performing in character here.
One final thing before we let you go, Michael, and that is the question of the adherence to the Geneva Conventions. One of the memos that we're talking about said that Geneva Conventions on prisoners of war did not apply to al-Qaeda suspects arrested in Afghanistan. Today, the nominee defended that position, yet also said the United States will, of course, observe the Geneva Conventions.
Yes, the position on that remains very murky. Gonzalez's own position, for example, at the outset, he said that contrary to reports, I've never considered the Geneva Conventions to be obsolete. Well, they weren't reports. It was Gonzalez's own words in his own memo, which used, that term. And so there still is a lot of real slipperiness on where the administration stands in terms of applying protections according to Geneva. And there was, frankly, a lot of misinformation at the morning session about that.
And briefly, the hearings, continue this week, next week?
Well, there's going to be an afternoon briefing today, and they could wrap it up, because it does seem as if there's no doubt whatsoever that he'll be confirmed.
Michael Hirsch of Newsweek magazine, thanks very much, as always.
Thank you.
We'll be back after a short break with more on Alberto Gonzalez, his pass in Texas, and of course we'll take your calls on this issue. I'm Neil Cohn, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing Alberto Gonzalez, the man, the lawyer, possibly the country's next attorney general. And joining us now is Wayne Slater, senior political writer at the Dallas Morning News. Before becoming White House counsel for the Bush administration, attorney general nominee Gonzalez spent many years in Texas public life. As we mentioned earlier, he served then Governor George W. Bush as general counsel, as Secretary of State. Finally, he was appointed to the Texas Supreme Court. And Wayne Slater, you covered the Bush administration back in those days. First of all, thanks very much for being with us today.
Great to be with you, Neil.
What kind of reputation did Alberto Gonzalez enjoy in Texas?
Well, part of what we're learning today and in the last few weeks is pretty much the reputation that we saw earned early here in Texas. He was, above all, a Bush loyalist. He's not a showboat, likes to work behind the scenes, very thoughtful, quiet, self-effacing, good guy. The one thing that happened when the Governor Bush named him as his general counsel shortly after being elected in 1994, was to bring on a guy who he got along with famously. Gonzalez had those two traits that George Bush liked. One, he was a bright guy who was extremely loyal. And so whatever Bush wanted, Gonzalez would find a way, in a reasonable way, to do it. The second thing was, Gonzalez had that one quality that so many Bush insiders have learned that they'd better learn. And that's the ability to distill complex ideas and complex cases or matters or issues into fairly short, brief, succinct presentations, deliver them clearly so that the governor, or now the president, can understand them well.
Well, as you know, in a recent article, journalist Alan Berlow brought to light a lot of the memos that then-counsel Gonzalez wrote to then-Governor Bush on issues of clemency, prisoners who were facing the death penalty there in Texas. And there have been a lot of allegations that these memos were indeed too concise.
Yeah, deficient in giving the other side. I saw that piece, and we had read, obviously, some earlier memos. That's the criticism, I think, of the attorneys for these doomed prisoners. I have to tell you, one of the things that Gonzalez did, and this is neither positive nor negative, or perhaps positive-negative, depending on how you look at it, is he was able, he was obligated by law and constitution in Texas to deliver the, basically to vet these death penalty cases before an execution and to present the essence of the case to the governor in advance of the execution for the governor's judgment if he wanted to delay or pardon or offer clemency. And in these cases, Gonzalez was very successful in putting into short order often very long, complicated cases. The presentations that he made were political orthodoxy. That is to say, to be charitable, he was able to put together exactly what the governor wanted to hear with respect to these cases. In Texas, the death penalty is wildly popular with Texas voters. George Bush's predecessor, Ann Richards, a political Democrat liberal, also supported the death penalty. So you had a sense that Al Gonzalez's job was to put together these briefing papers in advance of executions that looked at the legal questions, looked at the outstanding appealable arguments, but presented to the governor in a fairly succinct way reasons that the governor should do nothing but allow the execution to continue. And he did that.
Then he went on to serve. He was appointed by Governor Bush to the Texas Supreme Court. In that role, did he continue to tell the governor what he wanted to hear?
I think so. The interesting thing about Gonzalez is you see the political left attacking Gonzalez as some kind of evil guy. Certainly, the interpretation of these memos presents some disturbing questions. But in Texas, what we saw was a guy who, again, was offering up pretty much political orthodoxy consistent with what the governor wanted, desired, or the governor's views or attitudes, positions. As a member of the court, Al Gonzalez was, by and large, a pro-business jurist. He was a member of the Texas Supreme Court, the highest civil court in Texas. This was the court that took on the tort issues, those civil lawsuits and so forth. And more often than not, he ruled in favor of business, but not always. And I think that's kind of the interesting thing about Gonzalez. With respect to these tort issues, he was not some lackey of the business community. He sometimes, in some cases, important cases, ruled in the favor of the injured plaintiff. Later, in the issue of abortion, he also showed himself to be, and this is heresy here in Texas, but somewhat a political moderate, even though he is politically a conservative.
One final question for you, and this is regard to the other theme that we heard some of at the hearing here in Washington today, and that is that American dream story of Alberto Gonzalez, the son of migrants, who's now risen to the White House and perhaps to become Attorney General.
Well, you have to. I mean, this is an extraordinary story, and it's the real thing. This is a guy whose parents were migrants, who, when he graduated from high school, did not have the money to go to college, so he went to the Air Force, ended up at Rice, simply because he is just extraordinarily bright, ended up then at Harvard Law, and finds himself today, first in the governor's office in Texas as his general counsel, a member of the Texas Supreme Court, and today in Washington, D.C., as the nation's nominee to be Attorney General. And let me tell you, this is a guy who clearly is on the fast track for the U.S. Supreme Court. It is an extraordinary story, and it's the kind of thing, independent of the politics, that I think so many people embrace, and you saw even some Democrats today acknowledge, that it's the kind of thing that only happens in America.
Wayne Slater, thanks very much.
Good to be with you.
Wayne Slater, senior political writer with the Dallas Morning News, who covered the administration of Governor George W. Bush in Texas. And he joined us from the studios of member station KUT in Austin, Texas. Well, let's talk about the issues of the nomination for the Attorney General. Joining us now is Philip Carter, former U.S. Army police captain. He joins us by phone from his office in Los Angeles. Good of you to be with us today.
Good afternoon.
Also with us, David Rivkin, who served in both the Reagan and the first Bush administration. He's now the administration of the first President Bush, I should say. He's now a partner at Baker and Hostetler, a law office here in Washington, D.C. And thank you for joining us today.
Nice to be with you.
Philip, let's begin with you. What kind of counsel has Alberto Gonzalez been? Has his advice been to the governor and to the president been good advice?
Well, I think your last guest was right about his advice to Governor Bush. It was essentially the advice that the governor wanted, and it was the advice that the people of Texas also wanted. But in the White House, I'm not so sure that he's done yeoman's work for the president. While he's given him what he wants, particularly in the form of memoranda which authorize interrogation tactics and detention policies. It hasn't exactly been sound advice, and in fact, the administration suffered a stunning defeat last summer before the Supreme Court, largely because of legal positions adopted pursuant to this advice.
David Rifkin, there is another school that says his advice was sound and that, well, the administration has rejected some aspects of that previous advice.
Well, my own experience, and I think experience of many folks, there's always an ongoing legal dialogue in any administration when you deal with difficult issues. But I disagree with Philip. I think what has happened here, and not just the administration, this country ought to be commended. You're dealing with enormously tough issues. In the aftermath of September 11, we suffered the worst attack, worst number of casualties in American soil since Pearl Harbor. You have people exploring some very tough and, frankly, very unpleasant issues. What is the definition of torture? Can we use coercive interrogation techniques that fall short of torture, but nevertheless, you know, here's a British expression, not exactly cricket. The fact that the lawyers sat down and try to answer those questions and answers evolved over time is enormously commendable. I cannot think of any democracy that has even done that. So asking the questions and getting at the answers is a good thing. And remember, in the so-called torture memo of August 2002, what they've done is they've sketched the outer parameters of the congressional definition of torture, but definitely use the word severe. So we can talk about what is severe, but there's definitely that qualifier. So not every pain and suffering, not every infliction of distress is torture. And that's all that this memo is trying to do.
One of the other issues that was coming up prominently in questions in the Senate hearings this morning is the question of the Geneva Conventions and its applicability in the war on terrorism in Afghanistan, in particular, in this regard. And Philip Carter, the memo that we're talking about, said the strictures of the Geneva Conventions were quaint.
Well, that's the great quotable paragraph, but the meat of the memo is actually more significant. It's a blanket determination that these guys don't qualify for lawful combatant status. That may well be true on the merits, but the fact of the matter is that the administration sidestepped very important Geneva procedural provisions having to deal with that decision, and in fact have essentially flouted international law as a result, and also Army regulations which exist to decide whether someone's a combatant or not. And you know, we should not just take the moral high ground here and say, well, it was wrong to declare this. We should also look at this practically, as Colin Powell and his legal staff did at the time. American Special Forces soldiers don't wear uniforms either. They don't always carry their arms openly either. And by engaging in this kind of a policy, we've put our own soldiers at risk.
If I can weigh in on this, first of all, this is a much easier issue. A couple of points. Every single federal court, in which there are three, there's a Walker Lynn, Eastern District of Virginia Court, there's a Perdue Court in New York, and there's another court, District Court in Illinois. Three federal district courts have looked at the question of whether or not Al-Qaeda and Taliban members en masse can be declared to be unlawful combatants. They all blessed this decision. No court has ruled otherwise. That was not an issue before the Supreme Court last summer. This is a very simple case. Beyond a shadow of a doubt, a private organization like Al-Qaeda doesn't get anywhere close to having eligibility under what is, in essence, a species of multi-state contract. With regard to Taliban, the analysis is a little more complicated, but it's not even close. The point that Philip is talking about, this is Article 5, it says, in case of doubt, you go for case-by-case determination. In case of no doubt, which is the case here, because Taliban did not qualify as regular armed forces of a state, taking into account the key criteria that you have to satisfy. The fact that we did not give eligibility to people who do not qualify for it does not diminish Geneva Conventions. All it does is uphold the standards in Geneva Convention. And as to American Special Forces, let's be candid, they do not qualify either. People who fight out of uniform do not qualify for POW treatment.
As
a fact, it works one way, it works the same way for us as it works for those people.
If I may respond briefly, Mr. Rifkin, you're mistaken. The district court in the Washington, D.C. area decided in November 2004 in Hamdan v. Rumsfeld that not only was the president not a tribunal, but that the one detainee in that case may well be entitled to Geneva Convention protections. And that case is now pending before the D.C.
That is the Robertson's decision.
Yes, and that's the reason why the military commissions have been joined.
We're both lawyers, and there's not enough time to get into technicalities. But that is not exactly the way this issue is presented. In the Walker Lynn case, Walker Lynn lawyers filed a motion alleging that he had a combatant immunity. The district court judge said no, upholding the administration's position that Taliban and MAS were unlawful combatants. And these are not criteria. Look, there are four so-called magic criteria: discernible uniform, bearing arms openly, belonging to organization, transparent chain of command, and organization that makes an institutional commitment to comply with laws of warfare. This criteria, Philip, can only be satisfied on an institutional basis. You can be Mother Teresa if you join a bunch of unlawful combatants. You cannot, on an individual basis, comply with the four criteria, at least with the two of them. And there's nothing wrong with this analysis. I mean, this is unfortunately has acquired, quasi-ideological status. As a matter of law, unlike parsing the word severe, this is not even close.
No, it is close.
Excuse me. We're talking about the nomination of Alberto Gonzalez to be Attorney General of the United States, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a listener involved in the conversation. We appreciate the idea that maybe that the lawyerly technicalities go beyond the scope of most of us. Our number, by the way, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is totn@npr.org. And let's talk with Anthony, who's calling from Auburn, California.
Hi. Thanks, Neil. I guess my question is, when I was listening to the testimony before Congress today was that Alberto Gonzalez was making claims that he didn't make those statements that I have been reading about. Did he or did he not make the statements that the Geneva Conventions don't apply in this case and the UN is a quaint body?
I did say that about the UN, but Philip Carter?
Yeah, those statements come directly from a memo of his, and I believe it's dated January 25th, 2002. It's quoted on most major media websites. He has disavowed a number of these statements at various points, most notably in a July 2004 press conference where he said that the most famous torture memo went beyond the scope of what it should have discussed.
If I can just add to that, let's leave the August 2002 memo. On the issue of Geneva Conventions, I would urge the listener to actually go read the memo. It's not the legalistic in full. The quotation is garbled. You need to look in context. The memo says two things. A, there are some provisions in Geneva Convention, including the references to availability of musical instruments, sports equipment. Do you realize that if you are a POW, forget about anything else. You cannot be kept in secure quarters. Do you really think it makes sense to have all the Taliban and Al-Qaeda prisoners, like in Hogan's Cures, go congregate together and play soccer and use hockey pucks, for God's sake? So he's talking about some of the provisions of Geneva that are quaint. He's not saying that with regard to POWs, those provisions should not be complied with. The other part of the memo talks about why Al-Qaeda and Taliban do not qualify for Geneva protections. People read the quaint reference as suggesting the Geneva Conventions, for in all instances now, is something we're not going to comply with. That is emphatically not the case.
Yet, David Rifkin, as you know, a group of former generals and admirals, many of whom, I should say, supported John Kerry during the last presidential campaign, but they raised questions about this. Raising questions about the Geneva Convention at all, they said, puts American forces in danger.
Well, I can speak to that. First of all, only five of those 12 generals or admirals supported John Kerry. Second, the issue is not just the context of that memo. It's the larger point of it. The memo says that the new way of war renders obsolete some provisions of the Geneva Convention. The real issue here is whether the U.S. can interrogate prisoners to extract intelligence from them. In old wars, people like privates and even colonels on the battlefield didn't have a lot of valuable intelligence. Today, arguably an Al-Qaeda operative does, even if it's a foot soldier. So there's a need to interrogate them. This memo started to provide the foundation, the legal foundation, for us to adopt increasingly coercive and possibly unlawful practices. So we really need to evaluate this memo in its policy context. This was the creation of the policies which led directly and indirectly to the photographs at Abu Ghraib and the abuses at Guantanamo. And we cannot be circumspect about that.
And Anthony, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Neil.
And we'll give David Rifkin a chance to respond to that when we return from a short break. Our discussion is about the nomination of Alberto Gonzalez, the now White House counsel, to be the Attorney General of the United States, and his controversial role in memos on the war on terrorism, the Geneva Convention's applicability to that, and on the definition of torture. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. We're also going to be talking about the troubled airlines, big changes today when we come back from a break. This is NPR News. Today we're talking about the nomination of Alberto Gonzalez to be Attorney General of the United States and his long-awaited appearance before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Our guests are Philip Carter, a former military police captain, and David Rifkin, who served in the Reagan and the first Bush administration. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address TOTN@NPR.org. David Rifkin, before the break, we were talking about one of the principal issues that was up before the Senate Judiciary Committee today, one that Alberto Gonzalez was asked repeatedly about, and that was the whether he saw any link between the memos that we've been talking about and the road to Abu Ghraib, the abuses at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo.
Thank you. A couple of points. First of all, we have, unfortunately, abuses, including torture, including rape, including murder, in every penal institution in the world, federal and state, in instances where nobody gets interrogated, and the rules are very simple. You shall not lay your hands on the prisoner. Those things happen, unfortunately, no matter how much you train people, because in every detention facility from time immemorial, when you put one set of people in a position of total dominion over, some abuses are going to occur. So you don't have at all to posit that those memos, which, by the way, nobody but a dozen or two senior administration officials knew about, somehow encouraged sadistic thugs like Mr. Grainer, who, by the way, abused prisoners in his civilian life. He's a prison warden. You know, he's done many wonderful things like slipping razor blades in prisoners' food and beat prisoners, as we know now, encouraged them. So that's nonsense. That's just nonsense. Let's take it off the table. We need to have, on a more positive note, as a country, a serious debate about what coercive techniques, well short of torture, well short of even inhumane and degrading treatment, which is one notch below that, we should adopt with unlawful combatants who are not entitled to POW protections, who are resilient to traditional methods of interrogation. What we should do, and I would submit to you, unfortunately, we're not having this debate. Keep in mind, a level of coercion is used in ordinary basic training. I mean, any of your listeners who watch movies, if people get stood at attention for 2 or 3 hours in full gear, they get yelled by drill instructors, they're told to go in and use a toothbrush to clean the bathroom floor. Are you telling me that we cannot use the level of coercion they're using with recruits in basic training to deal with these people? That's insane. That's not justified either by law. That makes no policy sense. Unfortunately, the critics commingle everything. Real abuses, sexual sadism of a grave, and coercive techniques like climate modification or dietary restrictions. Is giving somebody MREs, meals ready to eat, instead of his preferred food, is that torture? I mean, we soldiers in the field for weeks eat MREs. Is that something we cannot do? It's insane.
Philip Carter, some critics say that as the number of these incidents rises, it's clearly no longer the case of a few bad apples. Some say it is evidence of a systematic system of abuse.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I wrote this a lot for Slate last year, that it was one thing to say that the acts at Abu Ghraib were the acts of a few bad apples. But as you started to see more and more incidents emerge, from dozens to scores to hundreds, and not just in prison facilities, but also at the point of capture and the point of transportation and various other points in the military detention system, you have to start to wonder whether our vaunted all-volunteer military has this many bad apples in it, or whether it's been corrupted by the exigencies of this mission and bad policy from Washington. You can trace specific abuses, such as the use of forced enemas and stress positions and other things, directly to the memoranda authored by the Defense Department and the Department of Justice. Now, I do have to take exception to one thing. This stuff is not like basic training. I've gone through basic training recently. I've gone through other military schools. Ironically, the only thing that this is like in the military school system is our SEER school, that is Survival, Evasion, Resistance, Escape, where we train our own guys to go through the worst things that the enemy could possibly do to them. That's what this stuff is like. It's not like basic training.
Can I pose one question to Philip? Philip, have you considered whether or not the level of abuse you see now is worse or better than, let's say, in Vietnam, in Korea, in World War II, and World War I? Now, let me point out that the Schlesinger Report, but looked at it, points out that the stats are much, much better.
That all may be true, but we should not hold ourselves to the standard of the Nazis or the North Vietnamese.
Wait a minute. I'm talking about our troops.
We have abandoned that because we have sought to use tactics like our former enemies in order to get intelligence.
Philip, I'm talking about our stats. Our stats. The military has statistics going back to the Mexican-American War. Let me help you and point out that there's order of magnitude improvement over level of rapes, murders of civilians, abuse of prisoners between the force in the field today than obviously norm for the number of people in the field. And what happened in Vietnam, what happened in Korea, what happened in World War I and World War II. I'm talking about our forces. Our baseline is much better, sir.
You're right. And a lot of that traces to the increasing professionalism of today's military, which in many cases I would say probably more than 95% deserves to be commended here. The problem is that in this war, there's a concept called the strategic corporal. Every soldier's action matters.
This argument could clearly go on for a while. Let me ask you both to wrap up by posing you the question, do you think that after all of this, and again, this is in the context of saying that according to every political observer, there's little doubt that Alberto Gonzalez will be confirmed as the next Attorney General of the United States. Do you think he'll be a good Attorney General? David Rifkin, why don't you go first?
I think he'll be an excellent Attorney General. My concern is where's the nation seem to lose an ability to look rationally at those issues. We're looking at it hysterically in a very partisan and absolutist fashion, and that is terrible. I think Gonzalez would be a great Attorney General. He'll be confirmed, but really should step back a little bit from this.
Philip Carter?
Mr. Gonzalez will swear an oath to the Constitution and also to the to his position, and if he upholds that oath, he will be a good Attorney General. But if he swears allegiance to the president alone, as he's done as White House counsel, then he will not be.
Philip Carter was a former military police captain, now a lawyer, and he writes on military and legal affairs for Slate magazine. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And David Rifkin, Jr. Served as a partner at the Baker & Hostetler law firm here in Washington, D.C. He served with the Reagan and Bush administrations in the White House counsel's office. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Pleasure. Bye-bye.